Welcome back to the Hashtag Health Podcast. This is the second part in our two-part series on the future of cardiac regeneration in medicine. In the first part of our series, we talked with Dr. LaFlaw about the advances made in stem cell biology and how the discovery of induced pluripotent stem cells has allowed us to better study cardiac disease, test pharmacologic agents, and develop cardiac regenerative therapies. Today, we welcome back our guest, Dr. Michael LaFlaw, to continue our discussion on the research and clinical trials taking place using induced pluripotent stem cells in cardiac regenerative medicine.
Okay, Dr. LaFlaw, welcome back. I know you mentioned this on the first episode about going from a rat model into a pig model because it's closer to humans. Is there something specific that you would want to see in the pig model or any animal model before transitioning studies into human trials?
Yeah, so the paramount factor is safety, right? So we want to show safety. I talked before about this risk of arrhythmias. The last thing we want to do is to take a human patient that's already had an infarct, already has heart disease, and is already at elevated risk for the development of arrhythmias and do something that would make that worse. And that's something we feel like we can model very well in the pig. And so it's a good species in which to overcome that challenge. And, you know, there's other safety issues that you obviously want to address as well. People worry about the possibility of tumorigenesis. So these are pluripotent stem cells. As I said, they're defined by their ability to give rise to all the cell types in the body. We want to make sure that they're giving rise to the cell types we intend them to be, the cardiomyocytes, maybe some of the supportive cells that keep cardiomyocytes alive, but we don't want them giving rise to other, you know, untoward cell types. We haven't seen that in our animal studies, and we, you know, we've worked out our differentiation protocols very carefully, so they're of high purity right now. We don't see any residual undifferentiated pluripotent stem cells, but it's something we need to be vigilant about. And so by doing this in a large animal model where, you know, you can approach the numbers of cells you'd be delivering in a human patient, you know, that's going to give some level of reassurance. We can also deal with issues of delivery. And one thing we did talk about is, you know, whether this would be surgical delivery versus some minimally invasive approach. There are catheter technologies that one can use to deliver cells to either the heart or specific regions of the heart. That's something, again, we can address in animal models. So there's a whole slew of safety issues that we can address in those kind of models. And then ultimately, efficacy, right? So, you know, first in human clinical trials would be focused on safety, but this probably only makes sense to push into human beings if we have a good reason to expect a beneficial outcome. And the main endpoint that folks look at there are things like ejection fraction, which is a parameter we measure in human patients to tell how well the heart is pumping, kind of a measure of global contractile function. And so we can look at those things as well. There's probably some issues, you know, that we'll only be able to answer when we get into human patients. You know, a good example in my mind is immune rejection. You know, so if we're putting human cells in another species, you know, jumping across the species barrier with what's called xenotransplantation, we're having to use much higher levels of immunosuppression. And it's probably not going to be especially predictive of what happens with cells going into one human being or another. So I think we'll learn things when we get into human patients with regard to that. So there are some labs that are trying to model this as best they can, you know, putting cells within the same species. So you could imagine, for example, in our model, putting pig pluripotent stem cell derived cardiomyocytes in another pig and looking at that kind of rejection. But I think humans are idiosyncratic enough that, you know, I think we'll learn something there when we actually get to human clinical trials, if and when we do.
Yeah, that would not surprise me at all. And it's good to know that there's a lot of steps that everyone's aware of that needs to happen before we get there and what to look for. One thing that you mentioned that really piqued my interest is the immune system. When we're doing it in animal models, do they have less of like an immune rejection risk, or how is that happening?
The short answer is no. So In rodent models, in mice and rats, there are actually strains of those animals that are naturally immunodeficient. So they're born, you know, some of them without a thymus, and so they may not have the same immunity as you or I. Those models, people are trying to develop them in large animal models, but they're generally not accessible. So in large animal models, we're usually talking about immunosuppression with immunosuppressant drugs. And that's the approach that we've mostly taken in the pig model. But again, because we're jumping across the species barrier, we're usually having to deliver much higher doses of those drugs than you would, you know, from, say, a human organ transplant patient. And so those experiments are challenging because, you know, we need to immunosuppress to prevent the cells, the human cells, from getting rejected. But at the same time, you know, as in human patients, whenever you're immunosuppressing, we worry about infections, opportunistic infections. There's some other toxicity of the drugs that can sometimes damage the kidneys. And so we're always kind of walking that tightrope.
Okay, that makes sense. Knowing that they're kind of already immunodeficient to begin with, so maybe their immune systems won't attack transplant cells, I guess that makes it easier to study the science, but then you have to kind of work through that hurdle in the future. But again, that makes sense. You have to prove the effectiveness of the therapy first before.
Yeah, well, I should say, in the rodent models, they're inherently immunodeficient, yeah. Bred that way, if you will. And the large animal models, we're having to treat them with drugs, right? And, you know, as well as with prophylactic antibiotics and things like that, so they don't get infected. Sometimes these animals have to be reared, you know, behind a bubble, like you've heard of, you know, the bubble boy, you know, to prevent any kind of pathogens from reaching them. You know, we've had to sometimes, you know, do our experiments that way, where people, you know, gown up in the spacesuits and then enter the animal quarters, so, because things have to be so exquisitely clean.
Oh yeah, fair enough. Okay, I know this kind of came up earlier when you introduced everything about why your lab is doing what it's doing, but I guess just to have like a concrete answer, what would be the advantages of finding a regenerative cardiac therapy as opposed to our traditional MI therapies?
Yeah, so again, our existing therapies, at least our medical therapies, are really aimed at either slowing disease progression, so somebody, you know, heart failure is a progressive disease that tends to get worse over time. So we can kind of slow some of that process. We can prevent some of the remodeling, further changes that can occur in the heart over time. Or they're aimed at treating symptoms. Again, I talked about before, you know, sometimes people that have heart failure can start to build up fluid behind the heart. And so we can give them diuretics, water drugs, to help them lose some of that excess fluid. But once you have a scar, you have a scar, you know, for the rest of your life. And that's where this regenerative approach, you know, offers the possibility of not just slowing disease progression or easing symptoms, but maybe reversing disease. That's the dream of what we're hoping to be able to achieve. You know, something that currently is only possible by organ transplantation. Or there are, you know, the other approach that people are taking is a mechanical approach. So there are devices, you know, mechanical pumps, ventricular assist devices that, you know, historically have been mostly used as a temporary kind of placeholder while you wait for somebody to get an organ. But, you know, people have been trying to build the artificial heart, you know, since I was a kid. But it's another approach people are pursuing.
All right, perfect. This is probably the golden question, but how many years do we think we are away from at least starting these in human trials and then eventually having this as a therapy that might be accessible to many?
Yeah. Well, the truth is it's happening right now in terms of clinical trials. So we think our research program is about, you know, with our specific cell product is probably 2 or 3 years away from being able to make it in the clinic. But that's not true everywhere. So there's some early clinical trials. There's a clinical trial that was just initiated in Japan with injection of pluripotent stem cell drive cardiomyocytes. There's also a clinical trial in China. I know less about that one. So it's happening in Asia. There's also a large clinical trial with a slightly different approach. So another strategy that folks are taking the field. What we're doing is directly injecting cardiomyocytes from pluripotent stem cells in the scar. And that has some advantages, one of which is we might be able to deliver these cells in a closed chest, minimally invasive approach via catheter. But there's another approach that other investigators are taking, which is to take these cardiomyocytes, organize them into tissues, and then actually make patches that you could put on the surface of the heart. There's pros and cons about both the approaches. We can talk about if you're interested. But there's a large clinical trial with that kind of cardiac patch from stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes that's underway in Germany. And as I understand it, they're midway through that study. And I think they're planning to enroll in the mid-50s of numbers of patients. So it's a relatively large clinical trial. So still early days. All of these are initial, what we call phase one clinical trials, where really the focus is on safety, not showing that the therapy is necessarily efficacious. But it's exciting. It's I think a lot of people don't realize it's happening now. As to your question, you know, how long before this becomes a, you know, viable cell product? That's, of course, going to depend on how these initial clinical trials go, right? So we certainly know that a lot of promising therapies don't necessarily make it all the way to approval stage. You know, if we take, you know, sort of the optimistic bet that this is going to work, but it's going to take time, my guess is it will take, you know, a few years to, you know, several years to go through the sequential clinical trials that would be needed for regulators to approve this. You know, the other thing that's going to be a challenge we didn't talk about for the field, I think it's going to be feasible, but it's going to take investment and it's going to take, I think, some additional technological advances is scale up, right? So as I mentioned, during a typical human heart attack, you're losing on the order of a billion heart muscle cells. You know, I think that's kind of the upper limit of the kind of doses we're talking about. So if you think about making hundreds of millions of heart muscle cells for each patient, and here in Canada alone, we have 50,000 MIs a year and 500 to 750,000 people with heart failure. I think the global number I've seen is like 70 million patients are approaching that. You know, so there's going to have to be a massive scale up in terms of cell manufacturing capabilities. If this ever becomes efficacious, you know, to make sure it's an economic cell product that we actually can get out to the people that need it.
Yeah, that's a really big consideration with the amount of cells you'd have to grow. Wow. But going back to what you mentioned in Germany with the cardiac patch, is what they're doing, are they trying to like grow everything in vitro and have like a mature cardiac patch basically of cells and then doing surgery to transplant it? Is that their idea?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the idea is you'd have a patch that you would put on the surface of the heart. The, you know, the details of how they make it is you take cardiomyocytes and you can basically put them in a mold and you'll get little contracting pieces of heart muscle. And, you know, their particular patch are basically a series of kind of intersecting rings of heart muscle. You could think about like little pieces of calamari, but you kind of make them into a little spirograph kind of doily, and then they're putting that on the surface of the heart. As I said, there's pros and cons to both approaches, and I think it's important that the field be pursuing both approaches. And one may be more effective in one clinical context than another. So, you know, there may even be room for both. I think in general, you know, we've preferred to take the cell injection approach for two reasons. One, again, it's going to be amenable to a minimally invasive kind of catheter-based approach, which we think will unlock, you know, a larger potential patient population, you know, rather than cracking the chest and implanting, you know, surgically the tissue on the surface of the heart. The other reason that we've preferred the cell-based approach in our laboratories, at least in our hands, I mentioned we have these tools that we've created where we can ask whether the tissue becomes electrically integrated and is firing in synchrony with the rest of the heart. When people have used those tools to look at the patches that are implanted on the surface of the heart, they don't have the same ability to integrate and couple with the rest of the heart. I think the best experiments suggest that either doesn't happen at all or happens only rarely. And it's probably because the surface of the heart is, there's a lining on the surface of the heart that acts as a barrier to electrical communication. And, you know, so I would think if the patches are going to work, they're probably working through something that may be more akin to those kind of indirect mechanisms that we talked about. You know, there's a little bit of a controversial area. We'll see how it shakes out. But I think that that's probably the case. On the other hand, because the patches aren't integrating and coupling electrically with the rest of the heart, they also don't see the problem of arrhythmias that we've encountered with direct cell injection, you know, which is a double-edged sword, of course. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that they've been able to, you know, progress to the clinic and in a larger early phase one clinical trial, you know, more rapidly than some of these cell injection approaches.
All right. I know we've been talking a lot about the advances in cardiac regenerative therapy and the research surrounding it. I also think it's important that we touch on some of the limitations of the field and what we've been doing to kind of address those.
The limitation. Well, I mean, the biggest concern is obviously we need to overcome all of the safety risks that we already talked about, right? So I don't know if I describe it as a limitation, but is a concern that we need to be very vigilant about and overcome is things like the risk of arrhythmias, the risk of tumors and the like. I think, you know, the other concern that, you know, we give a lot of thought to is scalability and making sure that this is an economically viable cell product. You know, we have some benchmarks out there, at least in, you know, Western countries where we can, we, you know, will deliver a whole new heart in patients that have end-stage heart failure. But a lot of, you know, people don't realize that's $1 million medical therapy or medical surgical therapy. We would like to reduce the cost of goods with cell therapy to much, much less than that. And I think it can get there. But these are nonetheless going to be expensive therapies. So the more that we can invest up front in and scale up in manufacturing, I think the better. One of the things that we've learned in my laboratory in the past couple of years is that we get much better outcomes when we're pushing cardiomyocytes in terms of their maturation. So transplanting cells that are a bit more like the adult heart muscle cells they're replacing. So now we have a problem not just of scale up of making the cells in the first place, but we also need to have scaled maturation of the cells to get the better outcomes. And so I think there's quite a few hurdles that the field, you know, will still need to overcome. Not all of these have to be overcome before we first make it into the clinic. I think technologies will continue to evolve. But I think for long-term success, and the development of a sustainable, efficacious cell therapy, we'll have to accomplish those things.
All right, thanks for sharing that. Thinking about a clinical trial, what would be some of the predicted or ideal outcomes that you'd want to follow or track? Like, what parameters would you be interested in following?
Yeah, so there's, I mean, obviously for initial clinical trials, the focus will be heavily on safety. Right. So it will be, monitoring the patients continuously by electrocardiogram for, heaven forbid, you know, the development of arrhythmias, looking by imaging for tumorigenesis, those kind of things. We talked about another, I think, important initial question was going to be, would be immune rejection of the cells. Can we, you know, is that occurring? How, if patients are immunosuppressed, how are they dealing with that? In terms of other more functional outcomes to look at efficacy, there's some pretty accepted sort of criteria that have developed in the cardiology field for this. And I don't think it would be very different. You know, historically, people have relied very heavily on ejection fraction. There's different ways that you can measure that. So it can be measured by echocardiography. I think there's good data that using a technique called MRI or cardiac MRI is probably a bit more rigorous. And so I think ejection fraction by cardiac MRI is kind of the gold standard sort of global functional measure. But there's also an increasing emphasis on composite measures of cardiac function. And I think, you know, in later clinical trials, those are really what people will focus on, you know, where you combine different clinical outcomes, not just some of these outcomes that we can acquire by cardiac imaging, but also things like how far a patient can walk comfortably after a therapy, how much exercise they can do before onset of certain symptomatology, and those kind of composite readouts, I think, are pretty much the accepted standard for later phase clinical trials of this nature.
Perfect. So thinking maybe about like survival curves or something like that, how do you think if like these clinical trials play out, do we think we would see like an increase in 5 or 10 year survival compared to traditional MI therapies?
That's what you'd hope. Those sometimes end up being challenging things to tease out in clinical trials, especially with an intervention like this. I mean, that's the best data. There was a clinical trial, it was something called the BAMI trial. We talked about bone marrow cells, and there was a lot of interest initially in those as a cell therapy for exactly the disease that we're talking about. And there was a clinical trial that was going to use mortality as a readout. That's the ultimate hard endpoint, right? Whether the patient is alive at the end of the study. And so it was a good study design in that regard. That clinical trial was stopped when it was clear they weren't going to reach their functional endpoints. So it was actually terminated early. That was a clinical trial that was going to involve many hundreds or thousands of patients. That's the kind of thing that would, I think, get technically challenging with an expensive cell product like this. And so, you know, if we look historically, things like, you know, organ transplantation hasn't gone through that as a hurdle. We now know that you have better survival outcomes, but that was something that was shown later in clinical experience with the intervention. So we'll have to see how the regulators approach this. I'm not an expert in regulatory affairs and the kind of thing that they look at, but I think that will be a very challenging thing to, you know, on like a Kaplan-Meier curve, kind of show a difference in survival. That also requires it requires large numbers of patients and also a very long duration of follow-up to show that in a statistically robust way. Yeah, I think that's not going to be economically viable for something like a regenerative therapy.
Makes sense. Okay, I know we talked a lot about treating post-MI heart failure. Do you think that there could be other cardiac diseases that pluripotent stem cells in general could be transferable to?
Yeah, so I mean, if you can think of a disease that involves, you know, and this is going to be true for almost any chronic disease, that involves the loss of some particular cell type in that tissue or that organ, somebody's working on a pluripotent stem cell based therapy to replace that lost cell type. And you know, some examples, I have colleagues that are working on type 1 diabetes, where you lose the beta islet cells that sense glucose levels in the bloodstream and release insulin in response, and that you can generate those cells from pluripotent stem cells. There's people that are focused on dopaminergic neurons, which are the neurons that you lose in Parkinson's disease as a result. So if you can think of it, you know, and that's in principle, what's the exciting thing about iPS cells is, you know, it could be, at least in principle, one-stop shopping for replacement cell for, you know, any of the cell types in the body.
What about for, I don't know how far-fetched this is, but like thinking more towards the heart, like something like repairing a leaky valve, would that be possible with pluripotent stem cells?
Yeah, good question. And I should say, as an aside, some of these other cell types we're talking about would impact disease. I mean, diabetes obviously has profound impacts on the heart. So if we could cure type 1 diabetes, there's going to be cardiovascular advantages to that, obviously. But yeah, so there's a lot of interest in tissue engineering approaches to make things like cardiac valves. You know, people are also working. We talked about tissue engineering and kind of the concept of patches. We started with collaborations with folks that are interested in an alternate tissue engineering approach. We may be able to make more complicated structures by 3D bioprinting. So you could think about, you know, replacing the heart as a whole or the great vessels. There's, you know, a lot of interest in tissue engineering, vascular elements, those kind of things. So that's definitely occurring. I think a lot of those technologies are kind of earlier in the pipeline. those are going to be harder. So you're not just replacing a particular cell type, but rather making more complex tissues. Cardiac valves in principle sound simple, but in reality, they're not. The kind of hemodynamic stresses that, you know, that tissue needs to deal with, you know, with every heartbeat, times the you know, lifespan of the recipient. It's actually very, very challenging, technical parameters that you have to reach. But there's groups that are trying to do it. Absolutely.
All right, it's so cool to know that there's like literally everything going on in stem cell research. It's amazing to hear about. My last question for you, how do we determine which patients in the future would be eligible for a cardiac regenerative therapy? Like, would there be like a certain ejection fraction cutoff or like a time from the heart attack happening that you have to administer the therapy in, or is it something we still need more studies on?
That's a great question. And it's absolutely the case that there'll be inclusion and exclusion criteria, right? So we'll be an all comers kind of thing. And the intention is to use these preclinical models, these experimental animal models, to best understand as best we can, you know, how the cells are working, when the cells are going to be most safe and efficacious. I think in the case of post-MI heart failure, I think there's kind of universal acceptance that something like the cell product that we're looking at, certainly not going to want to intervene within, say, the first 3 weeks or so post-MI. This is not an intervention that's probably going to be appropriate for the acute phase of the disease. And you could make an argument, and this is kind of a risk-reward kind of question that, again, needs to be addressed in these preclinical studies. You could argue that there might be advantages to focusing on people that are even later on in the disease process. So people that have chronic post-MI heart failure or chronic ischemic cardiomyopathy that have already declared their phenotype. So the kind of patients that have end-stage heart failure, the kind of patients that are otherwise going to be listed for a heart transplant. And there are those patients that, for one reason or another, would be unlikely or maybe ineligible to receive a heart transplant that, might be a potential patient population for this kind of cell product. There's even been, and this is, the kind of thing that needs to be worked out. There's been some that have argued that patients that have end-stage heart failure, the kind of people that are listed for heart transplant, that get a pump called a left ventricular assist device. This is a pump that can keep the patient alive, can do all the work for the heart, that people that are receiving the ventricular assist device, and that's done surgically via an open chest approach, that patients, while they're receiving a ventricular assist device, might be a good candidate to receive these cells because, you're going to have the chest open anyways. You're going to be exposing the heart to put in the device. You could surgically implant the cells at that time. And if something went wrong, they still have the pump that can do 100% of their cardiac output. So you have that crutch of the heart there. And then if some of those patients go on to get a heart transplant, you get the heart that received the cells out at the end of the experiment and be able to ask what happened to the cells. Did they stay where you implanted them? Did they become heart muscle cells? Did they change and mature? All those kind of questions that we're trying to answer right now in experimental models. So a little of this is TBD. I think some of the clinical trials will have different designs than others. As I said, there's a Japanese trial ongoing right now, and my understanding is that they're intervening a little later on in the disease process, but not necessarily limiting it to these end-stage heart failure patients. It's I think there's also different cardiac diseases, and my understanding is that clinical trial, I'm not involved in the study at all, but my understanding is it's involving folks that have both heart failure from coronary artery disease because they've had an MI, and also some what's called dilated cardiomyopathy, which sometimes can be heritable or post-inflammatory or even drug induced.
All right, that's all the questions I had for today. Do you have anything else you wanted to share with our audience?
I don't think so. Just thanks for your interest. It's always great to talk to folks like yourself, and I'm tickled pink that there's interest in the work that we're doing.
That concludes our two-part series on the future of cardiac regeneration in medicine. Thank you to our guest, Dr. Michael LaFlamme, for joining us today. And thank you for listening to the Hashtag Health Podcast. To be the first to hear about our new episodes, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, Hashtag Health Podcast. See you next time.